My name is Tim. I'm an alcoholic, and I just always love coming back to the Howe place. So thanks for asking me to share a little bit today. What it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. It's just it's like night and day. A lot of friendly faces here when I came in about 8 years ago, and I don't know exactly when my sobriety date is. We had a funny time trying to figure that out. I had to look in the book to actually find out what year it is, and you know, there's a story behind that, but I've been sober, about 8 years now since I've been back, and it has been just an incredible journey, a wonderful life, and, a lot of times I sit back and think I could have missed it all. You know, we were talking about that this morning, and, I was this close to missing it all, and we're all that close to missing it all, and when you think about we're all that close to missing it all, it's amazing that most of us are still here. And, you know, I was thinking this morning, and I really didn't plan for this. I like to get up here and just talk and, you know, really tell the story of what it was like. You know, there's a lot of good stories, a lot of bad stories, and really a lot of ugly stories. And we all have our stories, you know, and somebody told me a long time ago, you know, it's not the stories that get us, it's the bottle that gets us. And it's, you know, a lot of the stories are the same. Some are worse, some are better. But at the end of the day, you know, for me, it was all about taking a drink and then the drink taking me over and over and over again. That's what it was about for me. And I did that on numerous occasions after some lengthy sobriety. I did that after a couple days of sobriety, a couple weeks, a couple months, and even a couple years of sobriety. So, you know, that's been my story in a nutshell. I was born in Chicago to a Catholic family of four brothers and sisters, two older brothers, two younger sisters. And I was the middle child. And, I relished on that for a while, you know, until it didn't serve me any purpose, that it really meant nothing that I was the middle child. I just was a drunk who had a mental obsession with drinking alcohol. And when I took a drink, I didn't want to stop. And I can think back as long as the first time I took a drink. When I took a drink, I did not want to stop drinking. It gave me such an effect of being in the right place at the right time, something that I hadn't really felt in 16 years growing up as a kid. But when I took that first drink, it was just like, it was magic. And, you know, we all know what that's like. So we were in Chicago, and then we moved to Long Island, New York. My dad was an executive with Coca-Cola. My mother was a nurse. And, you know, I had a relatively good childhood. Relatively. We were close. We were. We always did the family things, and just had a solid background growing up. We left in 1972, Long Island, and moved to Dunwoody here in Georgia. And I think when I got here, I was in the fifth grade, and I remember. And I thought about this morning. I just always remember my first conscious moment, and literally, it was my first conscious moment that I can remember back to in Chicago. Just being around a bunch of kids and feeling separate from, and feeling different, and just really being there, but not being part of what was going on. Almost like that whole fishbowl, you know, the fish in the fishbowl, and looking out at everything, and just being in my own little space is the best way I know how to describe it. You know, I always felt like that, and that stayed with me all through high school. And then when I, took that first drink, boy, the whole fishbowl broke, and I had the whole ocean to swim in, and that's really what it felt like for me. And I can promise you, after doing that for 16 years of being in that fishbowl, there was nothing or nobody that was going to get between me and the stuff that made me feel like I could play in the whole ocean, and that's the best way that I could describe it. And it didn't. You know, the law couldn't stop me, and there was only one thing eventually that was going to stop me, and it was going to be me, and it was going to be, you know, 6 feet under. And that almost happened. So, you know, when we moved to Georgia, I had a good upbringing in Dunwoody, lived in a nice neighborhood, did all the usual things in the neighborhood, and went to Marist High School here in Atlanta. And sometime around 16, 17, I took my first drink. In the summer time here in Dunwoody, and boy, I tell you, the first time I was out with a group of people, and we had a sleepover out of the lake, and all I remember is drinking some MD-2020 or whatever we had at the time, or something somebody stole from a 7-Eleven, or and I remember drinking and getting that feeling, and then thinking to myself, it's on, and drank till I passed out and woke up the next morning next the side of a lake, and that was it for me. And I remember going to the pool. That was in the summertime. I remember going to the pool the next morning just feeling god-awful hungover, and somebody suggested that if I was to take a drink again, the hangover wouldn't be that bad. Mm-hmm. And I did. And it went away, and I felt good again. And to be quite honest, it was that simple for me. It never stopped. My entire drinking career was like that. You know, I drank till I got stopped somehow, or passed out. And then when I came to, it was on again. And I remember just the amounts of alcohol that I used to drink were just unfathomable. I mean, I remember going into decaf detox one time, and I registered a 0.417 blood alcohol content. And that's just from continually drinking and drinking and just eventually passing out and then coming to and drinking again. And, that was my drinking story. Now, there were a lot of things that happened along the way during that, as you can imagine. I drank as much as I could from the age 16 to 23, and I had acquired 4 DUIs. I had been in multiple detox units and treatment centers in Anchor Hospital 3 times, GMHI once or twice maybe, I don't know, I can't remember anymore, but I just could not stop on my own. And I remember the last time I went into GMHI was a defining moment for me that really stuck with me today. I remember my parents, I still lived at home, did not know what to do with me. And they had started going to Al-Anon at the time, and they were giving me rides over to 8111, is where I went to my first AA meeting, met some very interesting and creative people over there, one of them being Doc Crandall. There's some history to that a little bit later. I just remember going into GMHI, and they were talking with a guy named Don Phillips down at the Recoup residence down off Eastlake at the time, and he had suggested they take me in there. Well, they took me up to GMHI, and I remember my dad was always the easy one. He was the one I could manipulate, and he was the one that, you know, just thought it was a phase I was going through, or, you know, my mother being a nurse had a little history with this stuff, and she knew better. And I remember my dad walking me to the front door of GMHI, and I remember my mother sitting in the car. She didn't say goodbye, and I remember my dad looking at me saying, you know, you can go in or you can go do whatever, but your mother and I have prepared ourselves that you may die from this, and we're ready to go on with our lives. And at that time, he turned and walked away, and it struck me at that moment that, man, I was on my own, and I knew without a doubt that I didn't know how to live, I didn't know how to stay sober, and I just remember being back in that space of being in the fishbowl, but all the water was dark, and I couldn't swim, and it was just, it was such a memorable moment that it struck me at the core, and I did what, you know, any good alcoholic would do. They left, and I turned around and walked down to North Avenue and hung out with the bums down on North Avenue for a couple days till I ran out of money and had no place else to go. I went back up to GMHI and they took me in. That was like 4 days later. And I thought I was going to go in for a couple days and get out again. And I stayed, I think, 14 to 17 days up on the crazy unit for a couple of them at that time. And I just remember, again, just not knowing what to do. And I think at that time I was, you know, 20, maybe 21 years old. But when you think about that conscious idea, I mean, I had no idea what to do. I had no idea. If they'd have let me out that day, I had no idea how to live. And the only thing that I did know was that if I got my hands on some alcohol, I could find a comfortable space that I could live in for a little while and be okay. I did get out of there, and I took a taxi home. They did not come pick me up. They had gone to Hawaii or Puerto Rico, and it was a planned trip that they were not going to be there when I got home. And I remember getting out of there saying to myself, I was feeling physically a little better. I was feeling okay, and I had that first conscious thought that this is it. I'm going to be able to stop. Because I had thoughts of trying to quit drinking before that little episode. I had been into Anchor, as I said, three times prior for 30-day treatment plans, and I stayed sober for a little bit. And but I really thought that I could get out of there and I could not drink. And I had already been introduced to 8111, so I kind of knew where to go. And I think they had planned just not to be there to make me do it or see if I, whatever. I don't think they really knew what I was going to do, but they weren't going to be part of it. And they had to start getting on with them with their own life, I guess. But I remember getting home, and I took a cab, and the whole time I'm thinking, you know, I've got a fresh start here. I didn't have the shakes anymore, and I was physically feeling better. It wasn't 5 minutes before I got in the house. I was checking out all my old hiding places. And it wasn't so much the alcohol that I was after, although I was, but I just remember this overwhelming feeling of being back in the house and not knowing what to do as a young adult. I was that lost, and it was just the disconnection with reality, and then not knowing how to negotiate that was just unreal to me and too overwhelming. And I knew that if I could just get something in my system, I probably would feel a little bit better. I scrounged up enough change to go up to the liquor store and rode my bike and, you know, wound back up. They came home and I was passed out on the couch again, and they immediately escorted me in the house and dropped me off down at a place down in East Lake called Recoup Residence. And I was introduced to a three-quarter way house where you came in and you had to get a job, and you lived there with 15 other guys, and it was a great place for me, and it was structured and everything was on a schedule, and I kind of learned how to make my bed again, and they taught me how to do that, and they taught me how to get up, and they taught me how to look for a job, and more importantly, they taught me how to go to an AA meeting with a bunch of guys that were trying to stay sober. And you see the guys in the groups come in here, and it always brings back memories for me. These were some of the best guys that I've ever been around, and we just had one thing in common: none of us could stay sober. And that was back when Carp was down there. I see some people every now and then that I got sober with at that time. And you know, I didn't get sober then. I stayed sober about 6 months in Recoup, and I broke out drunk one weekend. I just didn't have anything to do, and I don't know why. I wished I had a good story for you, but I just broke out drunk. You know, the stories are all immaterial after a while, and that's how I like to look at it. But I remember they confronted me, made me go to a meeting. I had been working with a guy. I'd been going to meetings at NABA and the Clarkston Group, the old Clarkston Group at the time. And I had met a guy named Gene McCord down at Clarkston who would go to NABA on occasion. He, you know, kind of became my sponsor. I knew I needed to get one if I wanted to stay in Recoup Residence. And I really didn't use him. I just kind of called him when I needed something or whatever. He'd come pick me up. But they made me go to a meeting. They contacted him, and he came over and picked me up for an 8 o'clock speakers meeting at Clarkston Group. And I had been drinking all day, I promise you, and I just was in no condition to go to a meeting. I didn't want to sit down and have to listen to somebody all night. I mean, everything was about me. And I sat there, and, you know, I don't remember too much about it. I don't remember who spoke. There was no glowing light. I do know that they all went out to dinner afterwards at Denny's. I did not want to go. He made me go. And I sat with these people, a bunch of old people that looked like they've been drinking coffee for 80 years and smoking cigarettes. And I'm 22, and I'm thinking, what is going on here? And I don't belong here. I'd rather be behind North Avenue drinking some MD 2020. That was my life. So I went, and when we got to Denny's, he left, and he said, I forgot to lock the gate over at Clarkston Group. And he came back and made me, you know, sit there with those folks and have dinner. And after that, we went back to Recoup Residence, and he dropped me off. And he said, you know, do you have a minute? And I said, yeah. And we kind of went across the street. There was a little park there from where we lived. And we just had a good talk. And for the one time, he asked me a question. It was probably the first time in a long time that I remember telling the truth. He had asked me, was I drinking today? And I said, yes. And he asked me if I was interested in trying to change that behavior of having to get up every day and try and live that way, and I said yes. And he also said, I've got some suggestions that I'd like to try with you, and if you're willing to do them, then maybe we can make this work. And he said, are you interested? And I said yes. So it was three easy yeses, and I meant them this time. And he actually pulled out a little white chip that he had gone back to. He didn't go back to lock the gate. He went back to get me a white chip at Clarkston. And He had written on the chip, you know, my birthday, and gave it to me. And I'll never forget that. So, you know, when you're in meetings and you do these little things for people, you never know the impact they have. I mean, that was, what, 20 years, 30 years ago, and it's like, I still remember that he did that. And I don't know why it chokes me up. Gene has passed away, and I saw him before he died, but, you know, just the idea that someone would do that, you know, for me. So, whew. You know, I kept that chip, and that was my sobriety date. It was November 22nd, 1987. And I started getting real involved, you know, in AA. I was going to NABA Club, and I did not have a car with my DUIs, my four DUIs. I mean, I was not going to get a driver's license till 2060 sometime. And it was 1987. And I had surrendered that idea. I learned real good how to walk like Jesus and act like Jesus and just try and not take a drink. A job was given to me that my brother David had contacted some folks, and you know, it was like a customer care position in a new software company that was relocating out from California. And this place was located way out on Windy Hill at Interstate North Parkway, and you know, I did not have a car, and I don't think he really considered the idea that how was I going to get there. Maybe he did, but he certainly didn't get involved in my life to try and help me figure it out. That was my deal. And my family, because of Al-Anon, I will tell you, I'm a big Al-Anon supporter, did an excellent job of backing off and letting me figure out if I was going to live or die. And I think that my family is more than capable than any other family of loving me to death. They almost did. And maybe they almost did. Maybe that's a cheap excuse for me to say, you know, it's because some of those things happened because they love me too much, which is BS. But they're just, that's the kind of family we are. And so I had to figure out a way to get to Windy Hill at 8 o'clock. And my schedule literally for 2 years was without a vehicle, without a car, and without a license, was I had to get up at about 4 in the morning over in Eastlake. And I would walk down through the park where all the people were doing drugs and smoking dope and carrying on from the night before, and I'd get down to Memorial Drive and take a bus down to Five Points, and I'd get on a bus or a train at Five Points down to, let me see if I can remember this, it was a long time ago, down to the Art Center, and then I got on a train or a bus at the Art Center. There were two buses that left, one at I think 6:05 and 6:15 in the morning, and took a bus all the way out to Windy Hill. And there used to be a Bennigan's right there at 285 and Windy Hill, would drop you off right there. And if you think 2 years, I did go by that Bennigan's both St. Patty's Day and managed to stay sober. But I would get off there, and at the end of the entrance of Interstate North Parkway, I had to walk about 2 miles to work every morning. And then on the way home, there were two buses that left, and they left at 6:10 and 6:20 or something like that. And I had to be sure that I left work early enough to be on one of those buses or I would get stuck out there. And for me, that was not a good thing. So this was my schedule literally for the first 2 years, and it included a lot of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. I did that successfully, getting up and getting to work on time and doing my job, and then on the way home I'd catch that last bus, one of those two last buses, and I'd go down to the Arts Center where it would take me, and then instead of going home down to Memorial Drive, I would go north to Brookhaven, and then I would take a bus down to Buford Highway, and I would try and catch the tail end of the 5:45 meeting and then stay for the 8 o'clock meeting at NABA, and someone would usually give me a ride home, and I'd get home at 10 o'clock and I'd do it all over again. And I, to this day, I don't know how I did it. I did a lot of praying that I wouldn't drink again. I did a lot of praying that why I had this goddamn job, pardon my language. How did I get my, you know, but I prayed a lot, and I had a good God conscious at that point, and things started to happen for me in AA. They started to ask me to participate in things and make coffee, and then I became, you know, one of the chair folks, how they did it back at NAB at that time for the 5:45, but I got real involved, and there were Saturdays early on that I didn't know what to do, and I would go over to NAB at 8 o'clock in the morning on Saturday, and I'd stay there all day. You know, they have a clubhouse downstairs, and someone, you know, you think about all the things people did for me. Someone signed me up with a membership. So I had a key and I could go downstairs and I could hang out. And I hung out there all day on the weekend because I was afraid of what I would do if I didn't. And then I'd go home Sunday night and I would do it all over again. So, you know, I stayed sober for a lot of years. I was sober 15 years and somewhere around 8 years, 9 years sobriety, I started to drop off my meetings and my life was getting too important and I got a new job and I started my own company. And, you know, I had forgotten where I came from, quite simply. And I'd forgotten the things that had gotten me well, and I didn't pay attention to the people that helped me along the way. And more importantly, I didn't respond to a lot of the phone calls of the people that needed help like I did. And that's the thing that I think I have nightmares most about is, you know, did someone call me that needed something after I think about everything that everyone did for me? And that still sits with me. That comes up a lot of times in my four step. I have a lot of guilt over that. But, you know, I had a situation when I was about 5.5, 6 years sober. My brother died of AIDS disease. He was a career professional at Coca-Cola. He was, top of his class at LSU and died from AIDS. And we were real close. All my siblings were a year apart. You know, my parents were busy for a lot of years there. I had just started a new company, an IT consulting company, and he was in the hospital for one of the last times. And I know that we got a call that said, you know, you got to come down. He's getting worse. And, you know, I always tried to be there for him. I was about 5.5, 6 years sober at the time. And it was good and bad. It was good that we could be so close. And it was just bad to see anybody go through that. But I understood it. You know, I might not have been afflicted with that disease, but I understood the feeling that you can't change your situation and just being stuck in that. So we kind of got close over that period of time, maybe the last 8 months to a year when he finally let us know, but it got real bad for him. And he died in Piedmont Hospital, and I was there the last night he died, and I knew it was not good. And, you know, something at that time struck me that happened. And, you know, I've thought about this a lot. I remember sitting next to the bed and holding his hand, and you know, he had an oxygen mask on, and he had gotten to a point where they had him hooked up to a morphine machine, and he had looked up at me and said, "Can you let go of my hand?" David was very Catholic and very spiritual, and he looked up at me and said, "Can you let go of my hand?" He said, it's time to go, and he said, "It's making it, you know, real difficult for me to do that." And I thought for, you know, a moment that, man, to be that in touch with where I'm going and to have that kind of God consciousness at that point, and, you know, over what he was going through was just, you know, phenomenal to me. So, you know, that stuck with me, and I took a different direction. You know, he died, and we had a great burial, a great funeral. We had a great party that he had planned up until that point. He had a lot of friends in the Atlanta area, and it was a good time. And I remember I mentioned the 8 year mark. You know, he was very spiritual, and I had gotten to a place where I was very spiritual and had this reliance and awareness on God, and that my sobriety was dependent upon that. And I started to move away from that. And I really remember the thought that was in my head, that God, if this is what it's going to be like, that this guy's laying in the bed and that's going to happen, that maybe it's time for us to separate a little bit and me start. That was just my thinking, even though it makes no sense whatsoever. But my thought was I was angry at God for taking my brother, and I slowly started to gravitate away from AA. I started to gravitate away from God, and all of a sudden I had my program again, and God was out here up in a little box that I kept him in, and it was kind of like I could shoot him an email whenever I needed something. But that was the type relationship that I had slowly gotten into. And I can tell you now that had I stayed to AA and stayed in there and stayed active at NABA, there were a lot of people that knew me real well, and there were a lot of people that came to the funeral, and there were a lot of people that called and I didn't return their call. But had I made an effort to stay there and try and make it work, even as painful as it was, they would have pulled me out of that, and they would have looked at me in the eye, and it was hardcore back then. They would have told me to pull my head out of my ass, and that I was going in a wrong direction that was probably going to kill me, and that's exactly what happened. I remember being on a business trip at 15. I stayed sober another 7 years, and I was on a business trip down in San Antonio with a group of people. Nobody knew me. Nobody knew I was an alcoholic, and they started passing around these margaritas, and I took a drink down on the Riverwalk down there, and I remember my thought at that time was, and this again is only after a short period of time, and all the AA that I knew, that I had this conscious thought that I could just take a drink. I was living in Omaha. We had relocated. I kept my home here in Town Lake, but I had this conscious thought that nobody would know, and I could get back into AA, because I needed to do that anyways, because I missed all the good stuff that I was getting from AA. I took a drink, and it lasted 7 years, and I was about 3-4 weeks later, I promise you not, I was drinking a fifth of vodka a day again. And I was hiding it, and I had an executive position in Omaha, and I just watched it progress. When I look back at it now, you know, I slowly didn't drink during the day. And then I started carrying a bottle in my briefcase. Damon tells his story, and I laugh because that was me. You know, and then I had another one in my car, and then it just progressed to where I couldn't stop drinking again after a very short period of time. And I will tell you also, you hear about the progressiveness of this disease. It was a very short while before I'd wake up in the morning and I had shakes again, almost like I did when I stopped. That comes back immediately. It's just, there's no waiting room for that. You pick up right where you left off, and it's just the nature of our disease, and it's the biggest thing we forget. That's why people go out and don't come back after a very short period. They drink themselves to death. I drank. I tried to manage it. And eventually we hated Omaha, but I did some serious drinking in Omaha. I will tell you that I also got introduced to AA in Omaha, and there's some great AA in Omaha, Nebraska. And I met some wonderful people out there that I still keep in touch with today. I was introduced to a Cornhusker Roundup out there, which is, I used to laugh at that, a Cornhusker Roundup. Man, these people have nothing to do out here. Anyways, it's probably the best thing I ever did. I heard Sandy Beach speak out there 1 year, and funny enough, I did not know who Sandy was, and I was actually going to the meeting thinking, man, this good-looking chick is probably going to tell a really good story. It was a guy. And I found that out when I went to hear him talk, but his story was phenomenal. And he ended this story, and I have tried to find the tape. He tells a story about letting God into your life, and I'm telling you, it's stuck with me to this day. Talks about a guy locked in his apartment, you know, and he's got 8 bolt locks along the door. Then he goes and sits in his apartment. He's trying to get sober. And God's trying to help him, and he just little by slowly takes one lock off the door and peeks out the door. And says, I'm not ready. Shuts the door, goes back and sits down. Here's another bang, bang, bang on the door. And he comes back and he takes 2 locks off and he peeks out a little further. And it's like, you know, Sandy's message was finally take the locks off the door and let him in. You know, and it's synonymous to what we do in this program. It's like we're here. We talked about it this morning. It's like, man, we were right there to not getting this thing. And it's like, just let him in. And I promise you, the results that you'll get from this program and a relationship with God, they will absolutely blow your mind. So, you know, I better speed it up here. But I drank again in Omaha, and we moved back. And we kept our home here in Town Lake when I was relocated out there. It was horrible. I mean, it was just the drinking got worse and worse and worse. I saw a really cool doctor out in Omaha that said, man, you don't have a drinking problem. You need some Valium. That was pretty cool. I went through a bottle of Valiums quicker than I'd go through a fifth of vodka. So that became evident to me that whatever it was, I needed more than 3 at a time of anything. So, you know, I learned a little bit more about myself, and I came back to Atlanta, and it just got worse. And this is where a bulk of my worser drinking got. I was in hospitals. I was in Kennestone multiple times. I was in ICU at Kennestone. My wife dropped me off one Saturday afternoon. The blood alcohol levels were off the chain. I was drinking almost a half a gallon of vodka a day towards the end. I was never a go out and drink kind of guy. I had acquired 3 more DUIs, just so you know, so that's 7 lifetime. Couldn't drive again. I had to put one of those things on my car that you got to blow into. I had to try and negotiate that after drinking till 3 in the morning and figuring out what time I could get up and sober up and blow in that damn machine that would get me to work. I eventually got my license back. I don't know how, but I was in Kennestone one time. I thought I was going in for a couple days, and I was in 16, 17 days with 4 of those. I was completely out of it, borderline coma in ICU. And I remember my brother still tells the story that you know, they had all come in to say their goodbyes to me because I was pretty much done. They didn't know if I was going to make it. I was having serious withdrawal symptoms, both audio, visual, physical, I mean, everything. That's just how hard I drank. And it became time to try and get sober. My parents shipped me off to a place up in Athens, Jefferson, Georgia, called the Potter's House. And it's a Atlanta Union Mission place for men. And it was probably one of the best experiences of my life. I went up there literally with a duffel bag. Here's a funny story. I went up there with a duffel bag, and I remember being outside there on my cell phone, acting like I actually had people out to talk to, you know. And I remember a guy at the Potter's House that checked me in always tells that story about me sitting out there talking on my cell phone like I was some big shot. I had a duffel bag and a pair of boxer shorts. And they took all my stuff, and it's a long-term program. I stayed in there 7 months. I got sober. I got very involved. I always wanted to get sober. You know, don't get me wrong. When I got sober, I never wanted to drink again. My life was so good when I got sober that it just was unconscionable to me, the idea that I would drink again. And my life would get so good so quick, I just could never understand it for a while. So I graduated from the Potter's House, came out, and went into the 164 house here and stayed there for a while, and then broke out drunk again. And on a weekend or something with not a lot to do. And I'll tell you a story that I still remember to this day. But I went back up to the Potter's House again for a second time, and I graduated a second time. I mean, who gets to do that? Two graduation ceremonies. But anyways, again, I came out feeling great, and I thought this is a new lease on life. And I came back. Adam took me back into the 164 house, and I stayed there for a while. Two things happened to me that I'll never forget when I was there. I had a roommate, a guy named Charlie Hicks, family born and raised here in Marietta, great family of, you know, carpenters and cabinetry guys. And Charlie and I would come to meetings up here. We were close. We were right down here on Bell's Ferry. And, you know, I started to get real involved in AA again here at the NABA Club and the Breakfast Club. And we had a weekend where Charlie and I did everything together. We went up to Mississippi for a while and did some work up there and stayed sober. I was anyways. He had gone out one day at work and had a miter saw, I guess it was, that jumped off a nail and cut the corner of his knee and went on to workman's comp. And Charlie was a heroin addict and a drug addict. And they put him on workman's comp. And I remember I was the manager in the 164 house. And I kept telling him, I need to get your medicine so we can manage that for you. And we weren't regulated like that, and he would never give it up. He lived downstairs, and I was upstairs. Well, you know, I started to see it progressively get worse for him. Nothing that was unusual, but he just didn't seem right. And it occurred, or we found out later, you know, that he was down in the basement shooting heroin and doing pills, and his workman's comp was getting ready to run out, and he was petrified about the idea that they were going to take his drugs away. And you have to listen and pay attention to this story real well about the thinking that's going on in Charlie's head, because Charlie died, and I did have a chance to talk to him beforehand. But the idea that they were going to take his pain medicine away and that he was not going to be able to go in the basement and shoot heroin was where his life was at. Those were the decisions that he was making at the time when AA was right down the street for him. You know, those are the guys that don't get there. And it could have been me. He's no different than me. Actually, Charlie decided to, a week before his workman's comp was going to run out, hit his knee with a rubber mallet. It got infected. It got worse. And that was his answer. Pay attention to this. That was his solution to where he was at that time in his life, was to take a rubber mallet and hit his knee to where it would get infected again so he could get back on workman's comp, get back on medicine. And I will promise you this, if you'd have asked Charlie at that moment if that was the best idea, he'd have said, this is going to work. And he would have believed he didn't do it out of desperation. I believe that Charlie actually thought that that was the best decision at that time based on where his consciousness was. So he did, and I remember we were at a meeting Saturday morning, Adam and I got a phone call. It said, man, you guys need to come home. We left, and he was sitting in the basement, and I remember walking in, and I just thought it was unusual. I thought he was on dope. And he said, man, he said, Tim, quit moving so fast. There's trails going around the room. Well, what had happened is he had developed sepsis and his blood was infected. And we took him into Kenistone. This was maybe 11 o'clock and he was dead by 3:30. And it just happened so fast. And it just, and I was sad about that for a while. But the story that we hear about insanity, the insanity of this disease, and it's like, that's all I can think about is you get to a place when you're drinking that you're so bad, you don't even know where you're at. I mean, the insanity level is so deep that you don't even know what you don't know. And that's just crazy. It's insane, actually. He was there, and I got a front row seat to that, and it really stuck with me. And I tried to stay sober and do good and do the things. Well, I broke out drunk again eventually, and I might have been a year and a half sober. To be honest with you, I remember coming up here to meetings drunk. I just could not get sober. And again, once I drank again, I didn't want to stop. I did go back up to the Potter's House for a third time. And then I remember calling somebody that said, you don't need to be there. You know, you need to be back in Woodstock at the Howe Place, at the Breakfast Club. You know what to do. You've learned everything there is to learn at the Potter's House. That's what he told me. He said, there's no new secret sauce. And he also knew that I was developing a pattern where there was going to be one time I didn't make it to the Potter's House and it was going to be a funeral somewhere. But that was actually JJ over at the extension. And they came and picked me up, brought me back. Adam let me in the 164 house one more time. And I began to work. And I had one incident that last. And I'll try and tell this quickly because I'm running out of time. But I had an incident at the 164 house where I rear-ended a guy while I was working. I had my own renovation. Listen to this. I had my own renovation company. I was cutting grass to try and pay my rent, okay? And I loaded up a lawnmower in the back of my truck, in the back of my Jeep to make a living. And it developed into something big later on, but that's the reality. But I had rear-ended a guy over there, and I had been drinking. This was right before I got sober that last time. And I took off. You know, it was right there on 41. And I was coming back from the landfill. And somehow the guy followed me. Anyways, I got a call 2 days later on my cell phone from one of the, I can't remember the acronym, but it's the guys that handle the DUI cases. And, somebody runs into a telephone pole. These guys go out and investigate. And this guy was a career guy with Cobb County. And he called me and was asking me questions about my vehicle. And I remember sitting on the phone saying, I don't think I hit anything. And he knew full and well it was me. And for some reason, they didn't come pick me up. And he gave me a chance to come into the station. And that's what he said. He says, well, we're going to hang up now, and I need to see you and your vehicle. And, you know, I'm going to give you about an hour or two to come up to the station. And then we'll have to take a different direction. I immediately got off the phone, and for the first time in my life, I did something that I was not accustomed to. I called my sponsor, and he didn't answer. And I'm like, what's the point of this? You know? Anyways, this is the first time also that God did for me what I could not do for myself. I got in my car. I didn't do a whole lot of thinking about it, and I went up to Lemon Street, I think it is, up here in Marietta, and went in and asked for him, and he came out, and there was damage on my truck. And I told him what happened. And I thought that was it. You know, I think I'm going to jail again. I, you know, knew that I at least took a shower in case I had to go to jail. But we talked for a little bit outside, and he said, you know, wait here. And I just thought it was unusual that he just kind of gave me free rein to do whatever I wanted. He said he had to go back inside and talk with his with the captain. And I sat in a chair and I waited for him to come down. And I told him I was in recovery. I told him the whole story. I said he knew where I was living. Told him I was trying to get sober, and that's when he said, let me go in, I gotta figure some stuff out. Well, I had hit and run, I had all kinds of stuff that they could have gotten me on. Well, he came back down and said, you know, here's what we're gonna do. I also did not have insurance, by the way, and I was driving this vehicle. So he says, we're gonna let you go. Okay. He said, but you can't take your vehicle, you gotta get some insurance. And I'm telling you, I got Progressive? I called 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and I got insurance in the parking lot. But I couldn't figure out what was really going on. And he said, look, here's the deal. He said, you know, stay close to the 164 house. And I'm thinking he's going to start talking about my accident and the trouble I'm in. And it just, it took a whole different direction that I was not accustomed to, and nor did I think was coming. And again, this is one of these, God was inserted in this entire situation from the moment I hit that guy's vehicle. We talked, and he said he run it by his captain. They were going to let me go. He gave me a court date. He issued me a ticket for either hit and run or something, I can't remember, and no proof of insurance. I think there were three or four citations. And then he started to tell me about stick close to the 164 house, and he started to go on and tell me about his father died an alcoholic. And it hit me that God had put this guy in that moment to be there for me. And it blew me away, I'm telling you. And it was just, to this day, I'll never forget that. I have since gone back and talked with him and thanked him. And it was from that moment that I started getting, you know, real involved here in the 8 o'clock meeting. And I'll tell you that, you know, if you're not in the middle of this program, you're missing it, you know. There's so much that's available here for us that's not available anywhere else. So, you know, I started to accumulate some time in here, and I had some, you know, Bruce McPherson was my sponsor, and Bruce was awesome. Bruce was like, look, you know, I was one of these guys that because of my 15 years sobriety, I knew everything. I don't need a big book. My big book's up here. They got me to change that real quick. I wasn't allowed to come to meetings and talk or say anything. Three meetings a week, I had to be quiet and listen. I thought that was very cool, and I did that. And I sat right there in that, you know, every morning at 8 o'clock, and I got to a meeting, rain or shine, whether I had to walk or whatever, I got here. And eventually I started to raise my hand, and eventually I started to get involved. And another thing he started to ask me to do, which I didn't do for a while, he's like, look, don't sit on the outside, get in the middle of the room and start to meet some people. And they just taught me all the right things about when the newcomer comes in, go in and shake his hand and say your name, and then don't forget his name. You know, I remember when I was first new at NAB, a guy named Joe always remembered my name, and it was just that important to me. So what it's like now, you know, I'm about out of time. I can tell you, it's unbelievable what's available. I literally came in here the last time, and I was so afraid of breaking out drunk. I came in with my hands tied behind my back and said, I'm done. And I was literally done. You know, I forgot one other thing. I had been in Cobb Detox multiple times, probably five or six times. But the last time that I was in Cobb Detox, you know, my family dropped me off, and they were both, my son and my wife were both living over here. And I remember going in there, and I just remember having that overwhelming feeling that I'm done. And this was towards the end, but I remember saying a prayer. It might have been that last time I got drunk, and I honestly can't remember. They all blend together, and I've been so far away from that. But I remember getting on my knees and asking God to help me. And it was the first time that I remember really asking that and meaning it. And, you know, I'll tell you, from the moment I said that prayer, I didn't see a flashing light, but I felt something. Almost felt like a peace or an ease that I didn't just say the prayer. I mean, I actually said it, and I meant that I am done. I mean, I have fought the battle. You know, Clancy says, and I lost the war. I mean, I had nothing left in my battleship, and I knew it. And I knew that I needed something else to work for me because my solutions were done. And I think I took that and I ran with it, and I slowly started to celebrate a year and then 2 years, and I stayed involved. And, you know, I still live in Town Lake, and I've since moved out to Tucker for my job. I haven't moved out there. My job is in Tucker. You know, so I miss the breakfast club every morning, and I have to get out of Town Lake at 6 o'clock or you're toast from a traffic perspective. So I make that long drive every day, and people always ask me, man, doesn't that drive bother you? I love my drive. It's my quiet time, but I pop a tape in that Damon makes or something, and, you know, sometimes I don't pop a tape in at all, but I just, the quiet and the peace of mind. And, you know, for a guy like me that's brain is always racing, it's just like, that's one of my favorite times of the day. It's like there's nothing going on in here, and I leave the job back in Tucker, and it's, if anything at all that sobriety has given me, it's given me my mind back and the peace and ease and comfort of just being me. you know, there's so much more that's there, you know, my and there's so much more good that's there that I didn't really get into. But man, if you're new in the program and you're thinking, is this for me? Or if you're old in the program and you're trying to reinvigorate, you know, don't be that guy that goes out after a lot of years and tries to figure out that you can do this on your own. Or don't be the guy that goes out and says, thanks for your program, I'm going to go run my program now. And that was always my famous saying. And Bruce made it real clear to me that it was after my fifth step. He says, have you finally figured out that your program always gets you back to our program? And it's true. I mean, he doesn't have to say much, but it's usually so profound. And I have finally surrendered to the idea that my program takes me one place. And even though I don't get here often, I still have a lunch meeting that I go to in Clarkston, and I still go to AA. And for me, AA's everywhere. And it's like I hope that I never forget those folks that made me cry up here that did those things for me early on. You know, I hope that I can spend my life sober paying people back for that. And that's why I share it today. It's like, you know, maybe someone will hear one thing. That's why I say yes to this. Maybe someone will hear that one thing that maybe I heard or something. I don't know. Yeah, it's fun to come up here and see my name on a flyer. I mean, I think I'm important for about 10 minutes and then I forget about it. But, you know, get involved here. And I promise you, and I'll end with this, this program will explode your life to a place that you just, your consciousness just can't help you understand right now. And even though I've been sober another 8 years now, I look forward to what's out there even next year or 2 years from now. It's just something that, yeah, I've been sober 15 years, but this is so different this time. And I'm excited for what's around the next corner. And for a guy like me that's a control freak, I don't need to know what's around the corner. I know that somebody knows what's around the corner for me, and it's God. And I know he's got the plan for me. And that's just a great place to live. Anyways, thanks for asking me. I hope that made some sense to some folks. I felt like I jumped all over the place. Don't drink, go to meetings. And if you're thinking about taking a drink today, you know, get with somebody here that can understand where you might be at. I promise this will be the last thing. I think my sponsor did a really good job of helping me understand that I needed to hang around with people that knew where I was at. I was a habitual relapser, and he always tried to hook me up with guys who had a hard time staying sober. I was a kid from a relatively good upbringing that was a street drunk and a gutter drunk, and I think he hooked me up with people that I could relate to. And it's like, even depending upon, you'll find people who have gone through family tragedies and deaths and stuff that we will eventually go through sober. You know, pay attention to those people, because I love the people that come in here to a meeting that are just going through just the most unbelievable tragedy you could ever imagine, usually a loss or a death in the family. And they get through that, and we pick them up and we literally carry them till they can stand on their feet again. It's the most amazing thing you'll ever see in this program. You know, pay attention to that stuff, and because it will be us one day, and it will be me one day. And, you know, anyways, everyone have a great weekend. I'm glad I'm sober today. Don't know where I would be if I wasn't, and glad you folks would have me here today. Thanks.